Dr. Soloway commented on how our Patterns of Care survey of urologists and radiation oncologists clearly demonstrated a major shift in perspective on the use of chemotherapy in prostate cancer and the role of the medical oncologist, particularly with the recent demonstration of a survival advantage when docetaxel-based chemotherapy is utilized in hormone-resistant metastatic disease. I met with medical oncologist Dr. Anna Ferrari to review these research data and the clinical implications, and she began her conversation by reviewing the key trials.
Those studies were really designed to determine whether there was a survival advantage of the use of docetaxel-based chemotherapy, one in combination with prednisone, the other one in combination with estramustine, against a control arm of mitoxantrone and prednisone, which in previous years had been shown to be a palliative sort of treatment for control of symptoms. So in those two separate studies, one is the taxotere estramustine, the other one the taxotere prednisone, in both cases, there was a survival advantage for the docetaxel-based regimen against mitoxantrone prednisone. These were patients with hormone-refractory prostate cancer who had metastatic disease, primarily to the bone or to the lymph nodes, and particularly the taxotere prednisone study, many of these patients had symptomatic disease. Now, in the taxotere estramustine study, some of these patients did not fully have symptomatic disease progression, but they all had advanced disease with evidence of established metastatic prostate cancer.
And can you talk a little bit about what your experience is with docetaxel in your clinical practice?
It's been quite extensive for many years, even before the reports came out, and all of us have been using docetaxel or taxanes-based chemotherapies now, I would say, since the late 1990s. My experience has been extremely positive because what I have seen that many patients that are referred rather late, I would consider, because they're highly symptomatic, either with bone pain, sometimes with obstructive symptoms, some of them walking into the office in a wheelchair or hardly able to walk. Over the course of, on average, 2 to 3 months, you see remarkable changes, both in their symptoms, in their overall sense of well-being and quality of life. At times, or we would have thought that these patients who are quite impaired, even their quality of life or ability to move around, as oncologists, we are reluctant to start treatments because we think that the weakness or fatigue associated with the use of chemotherapy will make their quality of life even worse. Not surprisingly enough, because of the response rates that it elicits in the control of pain, these patients really reverse remarkably. And I could give you many anecdotal stories, but I think it's been the overall experience, and that's what ultimately the studies show. So it's not simply a PSA response. It's not simply saying, okay, we saw a 25% reduction in the size of the metastases, but it's more than anything, I think, and considering the stage of these patients, an improvement in their quality of life and ability to go back to, in many cases, their normal activities. I can talk to you about performers that I've treated that were unable to do anything and really go back now for several months to lead basically a normal life. So although these treatments do entail a certain amount of fatigue to them, overall in the symptomatic patients, the improvement is tremendous. And I will say that even in my own experience, in men with metastatic but asymptomatic prostate cancer, which unfortunately, I'm sure myself and many others have a number of these men that are fully active and need to remain fully active, but have clearly progressive disease, not only by rising PSA, but by the presence of metastases, particularly in the bone, that they are capable of pursuing their normal activity. And when I mean normal activity, full-time work activity, barely with no side effects, in extremely good tolerance. I have men that jog, for instance, and continue to do so. Some who have participated even in the marathon while having chemotherapy. So obviously, if you're in your 80s and you have other comorbidities, it's always a little bit more difficult. But nevertheless, in all of them, across boards, I would say that in those who are elderly and have other comorbidities, they're capable of returning to their baseline conditions. You're not going to make them better of their, you know, underlying medical problems, which many times are multiple. But certainly, I haven't seen anybody leaving work. You know, here in New York, there are many men that are very active in business, in Wall Street, in very stressful jobs. And I've seen them continue working full-time during chemotherapy. So it's really remarkable. I will tell you that, for instance, since I've been at NYU in the last year and a half, I admitted only 3 patients to the hospital. Every therapy I do is outpatient-based, and my admissions to the hospital are really generally for people that have no support at home or very elderly that are, you know, incapable of taking care of themselves when the disease is very, very advanced.
Can you talk a little bit more about specifically what type of side effects or toxicity you do observe, particularly in terms of fatigue? The common side effects we think about: nausea, vomiting, hair loss, and how often the patients are treated.
Depends on what schedule you use. If we use the standard schedule, the every 3 weeks docetaxel, which is the schedule that has been approved by the FDA, as you know, with prednisone or with estramustine every 21 days, with a higher doses, certainly there is going to be a hair loss. Generally, however, is not full baldness, as you would see with, you know, daunorubicin-based therapies, or certainly not. But there's definitely hair thinning and partial hair loss. Another symptom is fatigue. Most men describe fatigue as occurring generally within the 72 hours or so after treatment. So if I treat someone on a Wednesday or a Thursday, maybe on Saturday or Sunday, they will feel a little bit more fatigue, but not sufficient for that to carry over, that then they will not be able to go to work or even to work the next day. And perhaps the most common or potentially associated with complication side effects is the neutropenia, that decrease in the white cell count, which generally tends to occur anywhere between 7 to 10 days, as usually with chemotherapies. Now, most of the times, with the use of growth factors such as Neulasta, essentially the neutropenia doesn't even occur. In fact, in some centers, I will tell you, like, for instance, the VA, which I attend the clinic there because there are so many prostate cancer patients, they have established, that's not my routine, but they have established a routine of using Neulasta after docetaxel to avoid altogether the neutropenia and not having to follow up in 2 weeks or so for white counts. I'm not saying that that's what everybody should do, but it's very commonly practiced. So in terms of nausea and vomiting, I would say none. I haven't had that problem with docetaxel at all. No nausea and vomiting. Some men describe change in taste, you know, and this is also highly variable from one individual to the other. Some say, you know, the liquids don't taste the same to me. Others say the food, but certainly nobody loses weight. If anything, everybody feels that they feel more hungry, etc. So it's a remarkable change in their quality of life. Don't forget that many of these men, not all, but certainly the ones who had more advanced disease, sometimes even have loss of appetite related to bone pain or other confounding symptoms.
What about the changes in nails that you have observed with docetaxel and also in the lacrimal ducts, the epiphoria?
I have to say that I've seen that happening more often on the weekly combination than on the every 3 weeks, but it's been described for both. In fact, that was one of the most common things, the nail changes. Some men lost, you know, 1 or 2 nails in their toes, rarely in their hands, but also it is happened with prolonged treatments. Generally, it's not within the 3 or 4 initial months. I'm talking about men who have been on this treatment maybe for a year. I mean, right now, for instance, I have men on docetaxel prednisone, or this docetaxel, estramustine for over a year that have experienced no nail changes. So it's not across board either. And why this variation happens, I don't know. I also observed that the lacrimal changes, as you mentioned, and lacrimation was also most frequent with a weekly than with the every 3 week schedule. And in fact, in this trial I mentioned of neoadjuvant adjuvant weekly docetaxel estramustine, we did observe this happening. We use a number of different eye drops with steroids to prevent it.
Do you reserve chemotherapy for patients who have definite metastatic disease, or will you also offer it to a patient, for example, one who has a very rapid doubling time with just PSA-only disease?
Although these trials established the advantage for women with established metastatic disease, we know from all previous experience with other tumors that the smaller the tumor volume, the smaller the tumor burden, the chances that an active combination of agents against the androgen-independent cells is most likely to be effective earlier than later. But again, prostate cancer is a very heterogeneous disease, so we are probably going to eliminate the clones that are more sensitive early on, and clones that emerge subsequent to that one or survive this initial attack may be less sensitive. My own experience is that, surprisingly enough, and it's not my own because I have exchanged, and I think many of us have observed this, the surprising thing is that the emergent clones from this resistant population do remain sensitive to the taxanes. Sometimes it's not only docetaxel, it can be Taxol, for instance, in combination with estramustine. And you can get just a number of additional months of responses and asymptomatic disease from switching and sort of mixing the ingredients a little bit differently. It's amazing.
So you're saying that you would use chemotherapy or docetaxel specifically in a patient who had hormone refractory disease, but still only PSA disease, no evidence of metastasis.
Yes.
What kind of clinical situations typically would you use docetaxel in that situation?
I generally like to extend the second and third hormonal therapy as much as possible. And I think that all that time we gain, it's valuable time. But I don't necessarily wait for the development of metastases. If they failed the second or third line hormonal therapy and their PSA continues to rise, I think it's time to initiate chemotherapy, although they may be asymptomatic, because you know that that's where they're heading. And once the establishment of, you know, symptomatic metastatic prostate cancer is in place, control of symptoms and complications from the metastases is much harder to achieve. And perhaps because we know what we're faced with from experience with other patients, I think that extending that period of symptoms-free, although again, it's unclear if we're extending survival, makes a difference. And certainly with the use of bisphosphonate concomitant, or when the development of metastatic disease is pretty clear, I can tell you from my own experience that the amount of analgesics that I prescribe, I know it from my controlled substances, how often I have to renew the number of pads I use, that it's been a substantial reduction in the amount of pain medications we use compared to just before all these chemotherapeutic agents came along in the late 90s.
You talked before about patients coming to see you for the first time who are already very, very ill. Do you see referrals starting to come in earlier now as urologists and radiation oncologists hear more about docetaxel and other new approaches to systemic therapy?
Thank God, yes. Now I have observed two phenomena. One is that most patients are being referred when they're starting to fail the androgen suppression. Many times they're referred to me for second and third line hormonal manipulations, because it is also important for the patient to realize that these second hormonal manipulations have a limited activity and that it will require switching therapies more often. So there is also an adjustment of the mind, as I tell them, that has to go along. You know, they've been used to perhaps going to the urologist every 3 months, every four, sometimes once a year to get a depot prescription, and then they forget about it. But once the PSA starts rising, the scenario changes and the need to manipulate hormones becomes a process that you have to monitor on a more regular basis and determine whether there is a response and how long lasting that response will be. Generally, on average, say we're around the median duration of response to second hormonal manipulation can be anywhere from 8 months. Some people have reported 12 months. It's highly variable. But the patient needs to accept that. And I think that there's also a need for the patient to get used to the notion that there is the oncologist. You see, the perception of patients when the urologist or radiation therapies that have been following them for a number of years, sometimes 8 years or, well, sometimes shorter, but sometimes many years, and says, well, now I have to refer you to the oncologist, that has a very negative connotation. You know you're heading for trouble. And many of them feel, on the one hand, I get the sense that they're being essentially not abandoned, but that the physician who has been caring for their cancer for so many years now says, well, I have no more resources for you.
I wonder if you could put in perspective a little bit, more at a clinical level, how effective chemotherapy is nowadays in prostate cancer. In breast cancer now, we have a number of agents, and many women can go on, and it really has a tangible effect on their quality of life and to some extent quantity. We're seeing kind of the same thing in colon cancer now with some newer agents that are putting, you know, this very common disease into a category where metastasis now are not, you know, just a rapid downhill course. How do you put prostate cancer in that context?
I think that hormone refractory prostate cancer fits in closer now, much closer, certainly much closer than when I started in this field where I was not using chemotherapy because nothing worked. We're much closer to the breast cancer and the advanced colon cancer that we were, you know, less than 10 years ago, certainly before the taxanes appeared. So I, for one, who initially was very reluctant to use chemotherapy in these patients, I have become, now a long time ago, convinced that there is a true benefit both in quality of life and now we know, in addition, in survival advantage. I'm sure urologists or radiation therapists, having followed this patient for many years, will say, well, you're offering only 3 months. What has that to do? I believe that it's a definite improvement for all the reasons I said, in addition to survival, and because this really sets a landmark point where for the first time we can definitely state that chemotherapeutic interventions make a difference in outcome. Is it the optimum? By sure, it's the optimum today, but certainly not in the future. But this opens the door to a whole new venue of therapeutic interventions that really, I believe, will change the spectrum. And certainly the potential that these certainly very end stage of the disease may turn into a more chronic problem and in the long run extend survival even further, but even the development of pain postponed or to never occur. And that's a major achievement. Having taken care of patients in the past where once they developed pain and they had failed hormonal therapy, there was truly nothing else. It was purely, purely palliative care in the most pure sense. I think it's turned them around. I mean, people that can go from being totally incapacitated to go back to perform their activities, as I can name many, to live with their family, to enjoy their children, grandchildren, etc., it's an enormous change. It's undeniable.
What are some of the key clinical research questions right now that are being asked in terms of chemotherapy for prostate cancer in general?
Currently, as you know, there are anti-angiogenic agents which have proven to be effective in many other disease processes. And we have phase 2 data suggesting that, in fact, chemotherapy with anti-angiogenic agents is indeed a potentially more effective modality of treatment. So certainly that is something that is currently and will be in preparation or about to be tested in randomized clinical trials. We have other agents that target prostate cancer cells, so-called targeted agents, through inhibition of the growth factor signaling pathways that we know are turned on during prostate cancer progression. And those have been more difficult to determine which one is going to be the best next partner with chemotherapy. But I believe that agents that target the activation of AKT, which is such a frequent molecule activated in prostate cancer due to the fact that over 80% of prostate cancer have loss of this P10 gene, and that renders it AKT very active and activating of the androgen receptor, is a potential venue, the mTOR inhibitors. The same thing is true, for instance, for the so-called histone deacetylase inhibitors, which we know from preclinical data and for animal models that it can decrease the levels of the androgen receptor and enhance perhaps the sensitivity of chemotherapeutic agents. There are also those that inhibit the HER2 EGF signaling pathway, which also promote prostate cancer cell growth. And I just could go on naming multiple of these targeted agents that are likely to work with chemotherapy. A new exciting modality of therapy is the combinations with biologic agents, which we haven't addressed at all, which is the use of vaccines. And as vaccines are currently being tested in patients with metastatic androgen-independent prostate cancer that are asymptomatic, as well in patients with rising PSA. But already preliminary data seems to indicate that some of these vaccines are effective to increase survival. So one modality of treatment that we're thinking of is, in fact, combining chemotherapy with vaccines. It would seem almost counterintuitive to think that how would you think of boosting the immune system with a vaccine and at the same time giving chemotherapy that supposedly decreases the immune response? Well, in fact, there is some very impressive preclinical data and animal model data to suggest that by exposing to chemotherapy and inducing cell death of the tumor cells, in fact, there is a release of a number of antigens that having a boosted immune system with a prior vaccination would enhance the immune response beyond what just the vaccine could do by itself. So this is also something that needs further investigation and that is in the planning, and some of the studies are already designed to test the hypothesis. And I think that that's extremely novel as well. So as you can see, it's not just combining chemotherapeutic agents, which is what has happened in the past, but it's with signal transduction inhibitors and with immune modulators. And there's also attempts to enhance chemotherapeutic agents with agents that interfere with the bone tumor cell interaction at the metastatic sites. So the venues are multiple, and I can imagine 10 years from now that we will have identified the combinations that will be more effective, and even perhaps sequential combinations, because being prostate cancer so heterogeneous, what we may find, and I would not be surprised about this, with a very gentle regimen, let's see, docetaxel prednisone, you eliminate certain clones and you get a response. But then the other one emerges, and that one may be sensitive to docetaxel with vaccination or with a single transduction inhibitor or an anti-angiogenic agent because VEGF has been turned on at that stage more avidly. So I think we're going to design sort of a roadmap similar to what we have now with the hormones. You start with first line, you know, LHRH agonist, and then you move second, third line hormonal therapies. Hopefully in the future, that will be something we can do for very advanced disease. But even before we get there, before we get to the stage where it's so advanced, at least the way I look at it, that perhaps we can intervene earlier to prevent that from happening. And in that line of thinking, I think, although at the moment I know it's been very hard to sell large randomized clinical trials, we know from simply the risk factor analysis at the time of presentation or soon after primary therapy that the chances of progression towards rising PSA, metastatic disease, and death from prostate cancer can almost be predicted from risk factors. And it's in that particular group of patients that it wouldn't be. We know that those patients are not just going to have androgen-dependent disease. Those are going to have a combination of both, because that's what prostate cancer is, a combination of androgen-dependent and independent disease. Therefore, if we could essentially target the androgen-dependent cell population when it's at its smallest potential volume, we might be able to eradicate the disease. So I believe that it wouldn't be unreasonable to think of using combination of hormones and chemotherapy in the setting of adjuvant disease. It makes perfect sense for patients with high risk of dying of prostate cancer.
Can you talk a little bit more about the issue of the patient who's high risk and also some of the research that's come out over the last couple of years actually looking at various types of endocrine intervention, either straightforward LHRH agonist or in some cases complete androgen blockade, looking at it for varying periods of time from 6 months up to 3 years?
Well, perhaps the key trials that have come out, as I see it, are both from the radiation series and from the radical prostatectomy series, although not many in that area yet. But from the radiation therapy series, after the milestone publication by Bola, showing that adjuvant hormonal therapy for 3 years for high locally advanced localized prostate cancer did offer a survival advantage. And subsequent studies conducted by the RTOG also showing that prolonged androgen suppression for 2 years offers survival advantage indicates that there is the potential to cure a higher number of patients with high-risk localized disease. And I think by now it's been pretty much established that in patients with high-risk features at presentation and localized prostate cancer, the use of adjuvant hormonal therapy has become quite the standard. I think that what is not fully yet completely defined is how long that should be for. Certainly, the studies show 3 years and 2 years, but as you well know, there is also some studies showing that 6 months of hormonal therapy for intermediate risk patients may also offer a benefit without having to go as far as 2 years, because the risk of prolonged androgen deprivation, such as 2 years and 3 years, are mostly the side effects of androgen deprivation, which are certainly not welcomed by anybody. And chances of recovering potency and libido after 2 or 3 years of prolonged androgen suppression is very, very slim. So looking for options that would not induce androgen suppression would be an ideal situation. Now, in the radical prostatectomy series so far, the only data available is the study by Messing showing that in men with micrometastatic deposits in the lymph nodes at the time of radical prostatectomy also had an improved survival compared to no hormonal therapy in overall survival. But in those cases, the androgen deprivation was continuous. So there are several flaws to that study that may be related to the fact that there wasn't just a hormonal therapy control arm alone. But that's almost the only data that is available at the moment with regards to the use of hormonal therapy.
Do you generally utilize a maximal androgen blockade or it's an LHRH agonist with flare production?
If I'm going to use LHRH, I will use an antiandrogen preceding the use of LHRH because of the potential for the flare phenomenon, the rising testosterone levels. And based on the meta-analysis and the fact that in men with low-volume metastatic disease, the combined approach is better than LHRH alone, I tend to use the combined approach. However, in my impression, just from seeing the referral patterns, that's not what most urologists use. They use just the LHRH on the basis that there was no advantage to the combination. So in those cases, if the person has no evidence of metastatic disease and there is a complete response to the LHRH, I generally stop it after some time.
What are your thoughts about the studies looking at bicalutamide monotherapy?
The fact that it was compared to LHRH, combined androgen suppression, and at the follow-up now, I think it's 7 years, the outcome is almost identical between the two groups, is extremely important because definitely in those 7 years, the quality of life of this man is, as reported, quite different. And also offers an option that was not available in the past. In fact, in my own clinical practice is something that I use many times, androgen sparing approaches, particularly for the young males who are potent and do not want to have androgen ablation. And some not so young either, because they have the major side effects from testosterone deprivation, as we all know, not just loss of libido, but overall sense of energy, sense of well-being, aside from osteoporosis and loss of muscle mass, etc. It's an option that I use quite frequently. And I think it's been quite successful. Obviously, my experience is anecdotal, so I cannot speak except for the fact that the quality of life is significantly changed by using an androgen-sparing approach. I have my own ways in which I use the androgen-sparing approach. And I see this all the time now. More and more people are using, for instance, single-agent Casodex at 50 milligrams, which in the studies that were designed looking at 50, 100, and 150, 50 appeared to be way inferior to 150 in terms of its ability to achieve complete block on the androgen receptor and long-lasting remissions. And in fact, that's been the anecdotal experience of several other people, even if you use other antiandrogens. So I generally use 150. Sometimes in this country, as you may know, may not always be covered by insurance. And that's a potential problem, although I've also found that many insurances will go ahead with it. Many systems will approve of it because otherwise you would have to go to Lupron. And at the end of the day, it sort of balances out and it's a raw agent. The second thing I always offered men that are going on bicalutamide is to have breast radiation. I think it's very important to avoid the gynecomastia. It's certainly to the degree that it would happen without any radiation. Some breast tenders, it remains. The other thing I think it is important is that the breast radiation, at least in, that's the way I do it, be done with sufficient time to allow for the breast to atrophy, because most people start the Casodex and send them to the radiation. So you're on the one hand stimulating estrogens, you know, conversion of the testosterone to estrogens. On the other hand, you're given radiation. It's like both are not going the same direction. You're stimulating the breast and you're giving radiation at the same time. So I think it's important to give the radiation ahead of time, like 2 or 3 weeks ahead, and then start the Casodex. Also, my own bias is that as you give high-dose Casodex, testosterone levels rise significantly, something in the level of the thousands, and everybody feels very happy about that. The sense of energy and well-being is really extraordinary for some men. But I'm always concerned about the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone and the fact that this is something that we know, this is from molecular studies, that the high levels of dihydrotestosterone can displace the bicalutamide and activate the androgen receptor in other ways. So my own approach has been to use it in combination with finasteride. And in fact, I can tell you from some of my patients that we see decline to PSA just by, you can follow their PSA curves and see that the PSA drops, let's say, 2.5 or something like that, 0.1. And you add the finasteride, there it goes, down to the undetectable range. I've had men on intermittent monotherapy for a number of years now. I mean, most of these men, I will tell you right away, that I do explain all the potential. I do give them a spiel about hormonotherapy, and if they decide to go this way, what are the potential side effects and some toxicities that we don't know enough about. First of all, I make very clear that androgen suppression is the only established treatment that really does seem to affect disease for survival and survival. and is the best researched approach. That's established, and there would be no argument about this. I already have design, and we are proudly going to launch, hopefully it will be approved by all the committees, a study testing an androgen-sparing approach for future development. And the basic idea of this is that, similar to what was done with bicalutamide, you know, when you use bicalutamide at high doses, either alone or with finasteride, similar to the Ulexin finasteride studies, you're only interfering with the activity of androgens in the androgen receptor, is the peripheral androgen blockade only. But today we know that the androgen receptor, which is the target of bicalutamide, is in fact activated by multiple other signal transduction pathways. And also that the androgen receptor is upregulated in the process of androgen suppression or recurrent prostate cancer. So perhaps in addition to blocking the androgen receptor with bicalutamide, what we have to do is use additional blockers that we know activate the androgen receptor through these multiple pathways. And today we have all the resources to do so and to explore this option. So as I see it, we will be moving ahead with combinations of bicalutamide with various targeted agents in multiple arms to then try to pick which one appears to be most promising in a study where the standard arm would be bicalutamide with finasteride. So in that way, we will be able to, hopefully in the future, come up with combinations that will extend and will enhance the response rate to bicalutamide and maybe even extend the duration of response even much longer. And maybe we can avoid androgen suppression altogether.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Prostate Cancer Update.